We begin with World Watchers, and this is KAZU FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's Mae Brussel, and it's broadcast number 611, August 22nd, 1983. There were so many important news stories in the newspaper this past week that it would be impossible to cover them all. And my first frustration is try to run them down quickly and make it as many bases as I can, or I can go slowly and get caught up. But very many times people wonder why I'm on a particular subject that doesn't seem connected to what I said 2 weeks ago or a year ago. And then later the news catches up and they understand that, thankfully, gratefully. And this week I never actually saw, in the years that I've been doing research, or this is my 13th year on the air, so many different stories come out of what I call the major media. I didn't have to seek them this week, that do have a common denominator. Now, I can't go through all of them with you, but I'm going to name the what I consider the major stories of the week that were in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, some of the Washington Post, some of the Los Angeles Times, and share you the titles of these names that you'll be familiar with, and cover as much as the news stories as I can the pertinent points that were brought out this past week. There were articles about the Nugenhan Bank in Australia. The Wall Street Journal had three articles last August. They updated it with two more important articles, and this is the bank that has to do with CIA, heroin, cocaine, and so forth. There were stories on Klaus Barbie. If I don't have time for the details tonight, the apology to France, but the meaning of that 216-page report on Klaus Barbie. Updating John DeLorean and going into Licio Gelli, the banker for Italy, for the fascists all over the world who walked out of the jail in Switzerland. Mark Rich to update, half owner of 20th Century Fox, which is all of Pebble Beach here and part of Pacific Grove and Monterey. The Los Angeles Police Department, the blackmail investigation, the computers that linked to Larry McDonald and Western Goals, Henry Kissinger and various scandals around Kissinger and not only his role in Central America, but Kissinger, period, and David Graver, G-R-A-I-V-E-R, who I've mentioned several times on this broadcast. Now, the common denominator, I did a chart that I've been charting out these programs, the common denominator between those news stories that I mentioned are missing money, narcotics, mafia, and the international syndicate, the CIA, the Army, the military Pentagon, offshore banking, the Panama, Bahamas, the Netherlands Antilles, Switzerland, and Liechtenstein, Reinhard Gehlen, and the Nazi connections, and the murders of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. All of these people, or the people they work with, or the people they're on the board with, or their attorneys, touch bases with those particular items. The Nugenhan alone was missing $50 million to $1 billion when it collapsed, set up by the CIA. Klaus Barbie, I said several weeks ago, is allegedly holding $17.5 million in a Zurich bank from cocaine and heroin delivered by DeLorean by way of Joseph Mengele's attorney. DeLorean still can't come up with the $17.4 missing millions. Licio Gelli walked out of the Swiss jail. He had gone in to check out $150 million put in his bank account last September by Roberta Calvi. Mark Rich is holding on to the secret of his $20 million tax evasion scam with the Swiss government and the United States fighting over it. Why is he holding on? Because it involves Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford. Kissinger is involved with the Monte Carlo Lodge, Licio Gelli, and going back to on the board of 20th Century Fox that Rich owns half of. And I'm going to do some details on Graver. He was killed or walked away or was never on a plane that had $17 million that crashed in Mexico August the 7th, 1976. He absconded with $40 million, but there was $17 million on his plane. And that is one example of the missing money that these people are involved with. And the courts are chasing them all over the globe, but they're all related to each other. So it makes an interesting story. Now, I may wind up with Klaus Barbie if I have time tonight, but just one interesting story I want to share before we go to some of the other stories, or two of them. One was from the San Francisco Chronicle, August 19th, 1983. How the Barbie Barbie expose began. And this was from Newsday. And the gist of it is that a woman was watching television in New York in 1966. And she was concerned because two brothers, their last name was Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N, they were in the British Secret Service, and they were tortured by the Gestapo and put into camps. And they were telling about their torture. They were left crippled by the torture. And she heard on television in 1966 that the man who tortured them was on the payroll of the federal government. And she wrote to Senator Javits in New York City. She lived in New York. And she was very concerned about this and said, is this true? Now, her name just surfaced last week when the 216-page report came out, going out back to 1966. Now, this is the only political letter she ever wrote in her life. And she thought that Senator Javits would do nothing. She said it was apparent, but nobody wanted to do anything and nothing would be done. And the reason I bring this out is people say, what good is it for what you're doing? Or if they write letters, what good is it if we write? I can't tell you what good it is. I never met this woman, Sandra Sharkey, but her name was Zunick at the time, Z-U-N-I-C. She was married to Rudy Zunick at the time. She believed that she didn't like torture. She said she was an abused child. She didn't like it, and she wrote to Javits. Now, here's the interesting thing. One woman doesn't like torture. She doesn't think it's fair. She doesn't want her government to do that. It isn't political, left or right. So she writes to her senator. He contacts the State Department, and the State Department forwards the letter to Army Intelligence on July 19th, 1966. And he followed that up, just as Congressman Leon Panetta has followed up requests that I've had on Fritz Kramer. Now, he writes to the state, and they give it the Army. And the Army has a decision, this is written in the report this week, that they will lie to Senator Javits, and they will not tell him the man turned out to be Klaus Barbie. The letter was in the Barbie file. So the congressman gets a letter, a lie, that says that they heard about this criminal, but it was inconclusive, and they didn't tell him that he was located in Bolivia, that he had been relocated. They told them that it was a rumor that he was a war criminal and dropped it at that. So if you write and you believe that this country hasn't been taken over by the military-industrial complex, by Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger and Rudolf Winnicker at the Dallas coup, that's where it took place 20 years ago, the Army lies to the senator. So the senator is really a political eunuch. The Army is not accountable to him. Their taxes are paid by you, and they tell him a lie. Now, what happened? Her husband died 6.5 years ago. I will call, see if I can locate her. She lives in Babylon, New York, and her name is Sandra Sharkey. And I will try and locate her to see what her husband died of 6.5 years ago. Car crash? Cancer? Because Senator Javits, the recipient of the letter, who triggered this thing off by investigating it, is dying of the Lou Gehrig's disease, or the same kind of disease I referred to several weeks ago when somebody close to our family got an inoculation of swine flu and got what was supposed to be Guillain-Barré that went into Lou Gehrig's disease. Okay, I think that these diseases, many of them, are weapons. Isn't it interesting the two people that triggered this whole story, one's dead and one is dying, and he's in Los Angeles being experimented on by the hospitals there as a guinea pig. Two victims, coincidence? I doubt it. If you saw my files and you added it up, you wouldn't believe that either. Another story, how Klaus Barbie was almost used as a British spy. The British wanted him, and they interviewed him, and they used a Nazi, Dr. Emil Hoffman, H-O-F-F-M-A-N. I got this from the London Times, August 14th, 1983. And the Americans interrogated and used Klaus Barbie in such a way that he wouldn't want to go to the British. He was more useful to us. So when the Americans had him, they were more persuasive instead of going to the British. But don't think the British are cling on this any more than the United States government. The British banks, the American banks, funded Adolf Hitler. They had Walter Dornberger, Nazi war criminal in London. The Nuremberg people said he belonged on the dust heap of humanity. Dornberger and Wernher von Braun, who ran Dora concentration camp with slave labor until they were bones and piled until more people were brought in and more bones, the British released him and he became an executive of Bell Helicopter out in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and Michael Payne, an inventor and worker with Walter Dornberger, was the host of Lee and Marina Oswald in Fort Worth and Dallas, rather. That's how I happened to catch on to the Nazi connection going back to 1964 and realizing how big it was. So the British had a Nazi working with them, and Dr. Emil Hoffman, but he didn't recruit Barbie. Barbie came to the work of the United States. Isn't that lovely? So the state, the army can lie to the congressman, and when he asks the question, he doesn't get the answer. Now, I don't quote New Solidarity very often because Lyndon LaRouche and that gang are so flaky. They come out with a lot of crazy material that's contradictory, and they're always looking for the British or the KGB in their research. But the one thing that they do have together in Executive Intelligence Review or New Solidarity or biographies of people, where they were at certain cities at certain times and who they worked with, so that if you take their chronologies and what they have to say, some of it is very important. Their conclusions may be wrong. You may have numbers 2, 4, 6, and 8 and add them up. The conclusions may be wrong, but the numbers are the same. If somebody comes along, they can add them up better. And in New Solidarity, July 25th, 1983, they had an article, what did they say about the Kremlin's Kissinger sex file, or did Henry blackmail his way back? And it has to do with Henry Kissinger and the use of blackmail in the sex tapes of recently murdered Vicky Morgan to get into the Reagan camp again in the Reagan kitchen cabinet. Now, I helped them. They called me on that story. I don't write for them. And they asked me what I thought about Vicky Morgan's murder and Henry Kissinger 2 weeks later being put on this committee for Central America. And I said the day that Vicky Morgan had her head cracked, I mentioned Henry Kissinger and the William Morris Agency and the job, the role that Henry Kissinger could have. And 2 weeks later, Henry Kissinger was appointed to a position that Ronald Reagan said he would never have for him. But Kissinger had the contacts at the place where Pancoast worked and where Vicky Morgan had taken her book and where Gerald Ford is and Alexander Haig at the William Morris Agency in Beverly Hills. And Kissinger, I am positive, just as this article states and goes into the details about the smoking tapes. They talk about Fat Henry's political tunes in Washington and how he blackmails Hollywood with sexual blackmail and so forth. And all of that is true. Now, an important story about David Graver. I mentioned him. Oh, I didn't look up. I haven't indexed my tapes. It was about a year ago. A story on the Sterling National Bank in Boston. David Graver, Robert Fesco, Michael Sindona. And the reason I mentioned Dave Graver once was the links of the Vatican into Otto von Bolschwing and the network of Nazis behind the assassinations. And then a listener, World Watchers, reminded me, and I put on the air the next week, that when James Earl Ray, who says he's a patsy in the murder of Martin Luther King, when Ray was talking about the assassination of Martin Luther King, he had the name David Graver among his possessions, G-R-A-I-V-E-R. This is a fellow from Argentina, a multimillionaire. As I say, his airplane went down. Evidently, his body was never found. Involved with from 17 to 40 million missing out of Argentina. But he was on the way to buy a bank in New York City, and then that bank collapsed. He was going to purchase the American Bank and Trust. He owned the Swiss Israel Bank of Tel Aviv, and he wanted to buy this American bank. He owned newspaper in Argentina that Mr. Timmerman worked for, and he disappeared. At least his jet went down, and they believe he was dead. There was no proof. August 7th, 1976. The Houston Post has a long article about David Graver. This is August 15th, 1983, this past week. But the last paragraph of this article in the Houston Post is the one that caught my eye, because in talking about his multinational links to the international mafia, they have him to the international mafia, to the Swiss banks, to Argentina, the fascist that he worked for, the fascist government there, buying American banks. The last paragraph says, there's one mystery still surrounding the Graver case, is the shadowy Dr. Penaloza, P-E-N-A-L-O-Z-A. Dr. Penaloza was a high-ranking bagman who named, it says, the Montanaro bagman named Raul Jose Magario took payments from David. Now, he was supposed to be A-R-A-U-L. Doctor, this mysterious Dr. Penaloza received money from David Gravier under the name of Raul. That's about all we need for the Martin Luther King case to be broken wide open, because James Earl Ray said that Raul bought him his gun, told him where to go. He had never been in a Lorraine Motel in his life. He'd never even been in the town. And he was heavily financed. He had walked out of the penitentiary, St. Louis, Missouri, with assistance. He had gone to Los Angeles. He'd gone back east, Memphis, Tennessee. He had gone back to Los Angeles. He was in Mexico. He was in Montreal. And after he shot Martin Luther King, he left town and went back up to Canada and then to London and then to Portugal. And then he was going to London and then he was going out to Rhodesia, and he was picked up at the airport in London just about 2 days after Robert Kennedy was assassinated. He was traveling around all this time, had passports and had money, and said Raul. Now, James Earl Ray had the name David Gravier among some of his possessions, along with a associate of General Walker, among his the names that he had, David Gravier. And this particular story, Houston Post, talks about Raul took payments from David. Now, he was down, James Earl Ray was down in Mexico, and some of this $17 million could have gone to the International Mafia Assassination Team. This article claims that Gravier was blackmailed by the International Mafia, a wealthy Jewish family from Argentina working with the military junta. So now we have to go after the Raul who had the money to pay James Earl Ray, who got the money from David, and James Earl Ray had the name David Gravier. I don't think you need much more to put that case together. All you have to do now is to find out where the $17 million went that were on the plane with David Gravier, or where he is now. A year ago, there was a story about him that I mentioned on the air. It was the New York Times, August 27th, 1982, about his mysterious plane crash and the money he was carrying. And New Solidarity has a full-page story that came out on the links of him to Robert Vesco and Michael Sindona, and that would fit in with Otto von Bolschwing and the Vatican and Simon Rifkin, the attorney for the Sterling Bank, and also the attorney for Chris Kraft. John DeLorean is on the board of that. The New Solidarity was March 21st, 1983. So this new story just came out. This is August 16th, 1983, Houston Post. Very important story. Now, Nugent Hand Bank is a crucial bank. It's formed by Michael Hand and Frank Nugent. Michael Hand was murdered. Frank Nugent's on the run, they say, in South Africa. It collapsed. It had to do with the top generals of the United States, the admirals, with George Bush at Task Force 157, with John Paisley, who died. He had a mysterious death, and his papers are now being reactivated by his wife. Theodore Shackley was one of the men that came from Germany that worked with Edwin Wilson and Bay of Pigs. It was involved at counterintelligence with the Kennedy assassination. There were three stories, as I said before, in the Wall Street Journal in August on the Nugent Hand Bank, August 82. And there are two this past week. The Nugent Hand aided U.S. covert acts, the bank in Australia, the CIA bank. And I'm going to do more on that next week. I want to do a few other articles in detail. But in the meantime, go to your library and copy August the 16th and August 17th. The second article is The Bank's Links to Ex-CIA Men Detailed. Well, I don't think they're ex-CIA men. It talks about Admiral Inman, who has these giant computers now down in Texas, Mitchell Werbel, who I said could supply the silencers for the assassination teams out of Georgia, DeKalb, Georgia, and the Larry McDonald headquarters of syndicate organized crime. This bank and the people named in these two articles go back again to the coup in Dallas in 1963 and the Kennedy assassination, and I will chart and outline them for you, but in the meantime, I don't want you to miss them. Now, there were several stories, two important ones on Licio Gelli. I won't talk about all of them. One was the London Times, Sunday London Times, August the 14th. It's called The Springing of Licio Gelli. They don't say he was kidnapped. It's The Springing of Licio Gelli. And the main points of this article are that he's powerful, he's influential, he started business as a salesman with guns and pharmaceuticals. Then he sold NATO 40,000 mattresses and began his fortune in Argentina with Juan Perón in 1950s. That's when the Odessa Borman money was released when Evita Perón got her quickie cancer. Then he returned to Italy and became the head of the secret Masons and acquired his vast archive of people through blackmail. Now, this story tells how he walked out of that very tight prison. There's no way he could have gotten out without help. And it details the kind of assistance he had and who would want him out. It says he knew everybody in the Italian government, the ministers, cabinet ministers, the bankers, the head of the Secret Service, the civil servants, the judges, the police chiefs. They had to let him out because if he had a trial in Italy for absconding with millions, billions of dollars and a lot of other convoluted conspiracies and charges, too many people would be named. So he was assisted in leaving the jail. Then Wall Street Journal had a story, Gelli's disappearance adds to the mystery surrounding P2 and his role as chief. And finally, the Wall Street Journal says that, well, we didn't take him seriously and the Masonic Lodge wasn't that big, but evidently it was, that he not only worked for Franco and Mussolini, but when Italy collapsed, he worked for the Nazis in Italy afterwards. And he kept all the secrets of Italy and the worldwide fascist network. And he bought the controlling interest when it was going under of Corriere della Sera, Corriere della Sera. He had the largest newspaper in Italy. He was tied up with the largest bank, the Banco Ambrosiano. He's out wandering somewhere, but they detailed how he left and why he had to go, which seems perfectly obvious, except they try to say he was kidnapped, and that's insulting to the intelligence. Now, updating the John DeLorean story for you, there were some very important stories on that, but mainly an article in the Los Angeles Times telling about the Stephen Lee Arrington, Arrington, who was involved in being arrested with John DeLorean, and he was telling the police that he brought in 650 pounds of cocaine into the Mojave in 1982. He's not being charged with that. And he's brought in over $190 million of street value and another 700 pounds of cocaine in Los Angeles. And he's not being charged with that. But he would help. He pleaded guilty. He would help with the DeLorean case if they wanted. But also part of that article and part of the Houston Post is something that I have been talking about since Joseph Ball became the attorney for John DeLorean as soon as he was arrested. The attorneys for John DeLorean have asked U.S. District Judge Robert Takasugi, T-A-K-A-S-U-G-I, for 51, the judge has asked for 51 documents to be handed to him for inspection by the court before the case begins. Now, this is the judge that ordered the case to be in the tightest secrecy. And it took a court order and a questionable lawsuit to get into the hearings when the DeLorean case opens. And the reason I think the judges' names are important is once in a while they get bumped off or killed or become chief justices if they keep a secret long enough. So I think you should remember these names. Now, this judge has asked for 51 documents from U.S. Army Intelligence, the National Security Council, the Internal Revenue, the U.S. Customs, several departments of the Justice, the State Department, field offices of the FBI, the Defense Intelligence Agency of the Pentagon. That was Mr. Graham, who is part of Western Goals with Larry McDonald for Murder Incorporated with computers in and out of the Los Angeles Police Department. Now, that's a nice shopping list, isn't it, for a man who just happened to be caught with $24 million worth of narcotics to save his auto company. I said right from the beginning that this had to be a very big story, and I suspected that he was part of the Odessa network, working with Cardinal Cook out of St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. And John DeLorean is so big that when all this comes, they'll either have to let him off or they'll give him a slap on the hand, the wrist, and let the whole thing fade away like all these other cases. I don't know what they'll do when they try to get these papers, because they'll show his links with the federal government. There was another story in the newspaper about Lotus Cards. He worked with Colin Chapman. Chapman was a car designer until he died. I believe he was murdered as soon as DeLorean was arrested. Chapman died quickly, and he manufactured Lotus Cars. And as soon as he was dead, the car split. The company was going bankrupt anyway, and I got an article from the London Times that to rescue Lotus Car, Toyota has come in. Japan has moved in to take the company. Now, are these people being moved out? The Americans and the British and the Japanese and German are taking the car companies. As soon as DeLorean was arrested and Chapman was dead, then Toyota moves in to supply the money to rescue this car company, the Lotus. And there was another story about the debts of this car company and how furious one of the members of the board was that he wasn't told about the intended takeover of his car company. And he was furious. It was very secretive and hush-hush, which is consistent with a lot of things going on, transferring the ownership of companies that were once American or British to Germany and Japan. There was a dead meeting, according to the New York Times, on DeLorean Motors this last week. They're still looking for that $17.5 million. Now, I mentioned on broadcast 607 that I called the FBI in Detroit and told them the information I had. The FBI man was Dick Oglestone, O-E-G-G-L-E-S-T-O-N, in Detroit, Michigan. And I sent him a packet of information on John DeLorean, the Bank of America, his holdings, and the allegations of his buying his cocaine from Klaus Barbie before they were both arrested, of course. And the possibility of Fritz Steinecker, that's the name I had, S-T-E-I-N-A-C-K-E-R, out of Austria, the attorney for Joseph Mengele, is going to a Zurich bank and depositing for DeLorean. Now, the two men that gave me this information who've traveled to South America over and over again and are very interested in these cases, I gave them their phone number, their name. The FBI didn't call either one of them this week, never contacted them. Didn't follow up on this at all, and I sent them packets of material. And furthermore, one of the men was at a motor place. It was a show of farm delivery or equipment, and he was eating some cheesecake in a restaurant where they went to a party, and he'd had a reservation. I asked if they had walked in by chance. It was a dinner where he had a reservation, and he got very, very sick from the cheesecake. Not violently, but it was noticeably sick, really sick from eating this cheesecake, which does happen, and in summer weather, things go bad. But he got a phone call last week, did you like the cheesecake? How did it go down? And then 2 days later, he got another telephone call, do your children eat cheesecake? This was from a different person. It calls from the back east. He lives in the Midwest. So what he got instead of a call to inquire by the FBI on his belief that John DeLorean was with Klaus Barbie with cocaine down in Bolivia, what he got was a sick stomach and threats. And you may ask the question, does it do any good to call the FBI? Well, I think just as this other woman did with the story that turned out to be Klaus Barbie, you have to take chances. And eventually, we are going to find somebody who follows these things through, and it really does matter. Now, Mark Rich is one of my favorite characters. I talk about him a lot on the air, and I want to give you a chronology of Mark Rich to update you because, as I say, he not only owns a big hunk of the property up here, but he's an international man who quickly made $50 million within 2 years. That's pretty good. And he made it when the oil prices went up with the help of Henry Kissinger. Then he secretly bought 50% of 20th Century Fox that Marvin Davis obviously wasn't going to own totally, and he comes in with the money. Now, chronologically, I've done a couple of the articles on Mark Rich, but I want to take you chronologically where he is now because it's a scandalous story on deception or lying to the federal government and the collusion of the Swiss government in prohibiting the Americans from knowing where the flight capital is going, which is almost similar, not equal, but similar to the State Department and Army lying to a senator who asked a fairly decent question. The Mark Rich story really began in August the 8th. A year and a half ago, the federal government wanted the records of his bookkeeping because he has two companies, and he sold one part of oil to the other company at a depressed price and wrote it off so that he could have a $20 million profit that then went to a Swiss bank that belonged in the American tax till. So the New York Times, August the 8th, had the story behind the Mark Rich agreement that he will cooperate with the federal government on these charges. I see it is just half past the hour of 8. Maybe I should just take a one-minute break with you and go back to Mark Rich and some more stories, and also Klaus Barbie, because it's a good time to take a break.